Hello, I'm Louise Steinman, curator of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented free by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. You're about to hear Gore Vidal, the inimitable raconteur, essayist, novelist, playwright, historian, critic, and screenwriter, in conversation with Michael Silverblatt, host of Bookworm on KCRW 89.9 FM. In his memoir, Point to Point Navigation, Vidal travels in memory through the arenas of literature, television, film, theater, politics, and international society. And the gossip is great, too. This program was originally produced on November 20th, 2006. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
Thank you. It's a great honor and privilege to be here. I don't think that there's anything quite as astonishing as a library to a young person. And I'm grateful to live in a city that seems to be in the process not only of improving this beautiful library, but of developing better libraries throughout the city. I can't tell you how important I think this is. Gore Vidal is, it seems to me, a truly great American, a citizen of the Republic, a critic of the Empire. He has ventured in fiction, of which there are both historical fictions, satires, chronicles. He's even written one science fiction. He's taken on extraordinary movements in sexuality. I think that all of us in this room probably remember the day we were stirred and overwhelmed by Myra Breckinridge and what it had to say about us. The key to his enormously skillful set of styles is that he has studied literature and history. He knows Latin literature, and so it seems to me that he has seen an empire fall before. He knows what it's like from the past to live in the dying days of a great empire, even perhaps a not so good one. What I noticed when I was reading the really moving point-to-point navigation is that the style is incredibly supple. If you consider that he manages to move you to tears in a group of around 16 pages about the death of his partner, Austin, Howard Austin, it is astonishing to see him making you laugh at the terror of living in a place where lying has become endemic. He knows what Montaigne had to say about lying. He's really moving, as he says in this book, by point-to-point navigation. That is to say, all of the directions have vanished. We're living in the midst of a bleak night, and you move from subject to subject by instinct, by an instinct that has memorized the topos that you're exploring. And so the book really is a vital organism as it moves from place to place, from setting to setting, instinctually, changing its tone, but always maintaining that extraordinary patrician syntax, which I believe came from Cicero. I want to read just the end of a sentence because it has a magnificent kick in its joke. I mean, malice joins wit so frequently, and there are so many surprises. He talks about those people who think that the U.S. is at all democratic in anything except the furious imprisoning of the innocent, the joyous electing of the guilty. And what we see is that the beauty of the wit is compounded by the symmetrical elegance that Cicero taught us in how to balance a sentence. He is the man who has maintained the most equipoise in prose while he watches and chronicles the disintegration of culture. Welcome, Gore Vidal.
Thank you very much. As I was coming here tonight, a lonely former army bugler who was practicing his scales on the back of the theater. And as I approached, he played taps. I'm going to leave it at that. Anyway, it's good to be here. Also remember, for those of you up on the fourth floor, I'm speaking to you too. And here we are. It's good. This is one of the best readers I've ever known. You know, the United States has always produced better writers than readers. And every now and then you meet a really very good reader. That's what Susan Sontag was saying about him and what I say about him, behind your back. Now I've said it in front of you. So, what next?
I wanted to start. This is a book of endings, and I wanted to begin by asking you, how does one go about continuing while ending? What is it now that you work on and look toward with interest and continued vigor?
Well, I'm terribly excited by stupidity. And I find myself, you know, in a state of constant orgasm in my own country, you know. I mean, for once, they really are charging me up. And although I have a titanium knee, I like to think many of, you know, the excitements have gone into the knee and are generating force throughout my body. So I think absurdity gets some of us going. And anger is awfully good, too. Anger is very good. I can remember the day just a few weeks ago when our strange little attorney general, who, I tell you, it's Truman Capote come back to life. I mean, he's got that same voice. And how quaint, you know, the Geneva Accords are. And to hear Truman Capote coming out of what, and he plainly thinks he's Attorney General of Mexico, you know, where they have no particular rights, I assume, or that's what he assumes that we don't have. And I thought, how curious to end one's life with something like that as Attorney General. I leave for your imagination my view of President and Vice President. And I would take them more seriously had they ever been elected. So you keep going because that's all you know how to do. And some things excite you to wrath, and others. I go in for laughter quite a bit. Somebody said, how do you pick your friends? You talk about Tennessee Williams and Truman and blah, 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 throughout the book. And I said, well, I make friends with people that I can laugh with. Otherwise, you don't get much else from others except if they're awfully wise. And that's a long search very often. But people to laugh with who see what you do. I mean, thanks to reading Montaigne, I've become an expert on liars. And Montaigne has a great passage on lying in his collected essays. And he said, I think of all the vices, human vices, the one most deserving of capital punishment is the telling of lies. He said, our words are the only thing that make us human. It's the only connection we have with each other. And once the tongue is allowed to begin to lie, it cannot stop. He's giving advice to parents on what to do with children. He said, don't worry about them making a mess here and there. Worry about them when they start to lie. Because if they get into the habit, they may never break it. And they may very well become president and vice president.
So rather than any boy can grow up to be president, any liar can.
Of course any liar can. He lied.
You say about Tennessee that you laughed at the same things. What were those things, given the fact that you also say that you are more classical in your sensibility and he's a romantic?
Well, that made life interesting. I mean, when we were traveling together at different times and saw each other, he had a romantic view of the world in spades, really. And I'm more classical, Apollonian, whatever word you want to use. I'm more satiric. But my God, he was a funny writer. And he was destroyed in many ways by the man who made him rich and famous, which was Gadge Kazan, who was filled with energy and no subtlety of any kind. I remember going down to Philadelphia to see the Cat on a Hot Tin Roof's first full performance. And we arrived in the theater, and Tennessee was standing in the back, holding on to his head. And on stage were the principals, Burl Ives, his big daddy, and so on. And the audience seemed to be quite happy, but I've never heard so much noise on the stage. And I said, what have you done, Bird? I mean, what is this noise? Well, he said, I have yet to explain to Gadge the nature of metaphor. I said, well, where did you fail this time? Well, I wrote the tension in Big Daddy's family. He's just come back from the Oxnard Clinic, where he's had a cancer operation, and they're all waiting for him to die. And I wrote, the air is so tense as the people are gathering in the family that it was like a summer storm. Well, he gave him a summer storm such as you've never seen before. Poor Tennessee begins the play with a tsunami going on. That's when director does not understand writer. Writer understood success perhaps too well, and he knew that Gadge each time was going to deliver him a huge success. And he felt that made up for all of his life because he only lived for productions. He began as a poet. Then he would write. He was the best short story writer since Edgar Allan Poe, and they were great short stories. And then once they were written, he wasn't quite finished. He turned them one by one into The Glass Menagerie, into Players of a Summer Game, A Streetcar Named Desire. He, using the short stories, which began as poems, then went on to that, and obviously began as visions. And suddenly, he waited for a production. That's why he always went crazy when he couldn't find a producer and couldn't get a production on. And what he did was, once the living actors were up there in rehearsal, they had completed the entire cycle for him. He had gone from some kind of vague vision of a narrative, and then suddenly living actors, and he was lucky to have so many great ones, and they were lucky to have him. And suddenly there it is, and his work is complete. What he had only dreamed of, only imagined, suddenly, you know, I have always depended upon the kindness of strangers. That's pretty much the right reading. Kazan thought it should be soupy, and she should be tragic as Blanche is being led off to the loony bin. And I said, you know, this is all wrong. After I was a great person to have it your first run through, but he always listened. And I said, you know, this is her play. It was very clear Marlon Brando was going to take it away from her. nobody could do anything about that. He was just too strong to be on the same stage with this actress. So Tennessee was willing to buy into that. But finally, Claire Bloom came to play it in the West End in London. And I introduced her to Tennessee. He had finally said, reluctantly, he didn't think she could do it. And he said, well, all right, yes, do you really want to play this? She said, yes, I do. So we were sitting at the Mirabel in the West End just before rehearsals were about to begin. And he offered her a cigarette. She said, oh, I don't smoke, she said. And then he lit the wrong end. And, you know, she never did smoke, but she got through that one. And then he said, do you have any questions about the play? And she said, yes. And she attracted his interest. He finally looked at her and said, well, what's your question? She said, well, when the curtain goes down, and I always depended upon the kindness of strangers as she'd been taken off to the loony bin, Claire said, what happens next? Oh, he said, no one has ever asked me that question. I assume that she will go to the bin for a requisite amount of time. I assume she will seduce one or two of the better-looking young doctors around the place. And then I assume that she will be let out and open a fashionable boutique in the French Quarter. And Claire's jaw set like iron. You mean she wins? Yes, that is what I mean. Claire won every prize the British Theatre has to give for her Blanche DuBois, and she played it from the beginning that she was going to win this thing. And she was going to defeat Stanley, and sadly, she was going to have to defeat her sister, too. My lectures on Tennessee Williams can be found on practically any disc, you know, around the house here. I didn't mean to go on, but suddenly you were talking about what it is that gets through you through old age and so on. And I was giving you an idea of what his character was like and what I think the artist's character is like. It is enduring, and it is not taking too much from the world around you. And always fighting back. And if you notice in that play, she does fight back quite well. Her final speech is to Stella. Why do you want to hang back with the apes? Not a nice thing to say about your brother-in-law, but at the same time, she meant it.
I ask because you've had some of the best voices of your time watching your development, Paul Bowles, Tennessee Williams, and you talk in the memoir about the time when you realized that you had developed your own voice. It was, for you, four or five novels in, and I wondered if you can describe that voice and how one comes to recognize that you've attained a distinctive voice of your own.
I don't know that that's what you recognize. I think in my case, I was writing like everybody else. And I didn't think that was good enough, since I didn't like everybody else. And we were all my generation. My first novel was written when I was 19, in hospital, having been in the Pacific, and I had plenty of time in the hospital, so I wrote a novel. It got published, and of course it's full of echoes of Hemingway, and Hemingway has nothing to do with me at all. But it was the way, it's what I call the national manner. Everybody wrote in that, you know, as though it was the first draft of a telegram. And when you have nothing much to say. And suddenly I began a book called The Judgment of Paris, which Tennessee in his collected letters goes on at great length about. And I realized that there was something else. Because before I divided myself between poetry and prose, I was a pretty bad poet, very didactic, as you might suspect. And I just said, I better strangle this poetry, because it isn't any good. But I can do something with the novels. But what I need is a new way of saying them. And suddenly a whole new voice started in. And I never look back, except every now and then I hear something special, and that means a satiric novel is coming. I am Myra Breckinridge, whom no man shall possess. Where did that come from? I don't know. I was walking along a street in Rome by the Quirinale coming down from the palace. And I thought, well, what's that about? So I went back to the apartment, sat down, and began to write. I was halfway through the book before I realized Myra Breckinridge had started life as a man. It's the things you find out when you write. So it's often very good not to know. Tennessee always said, I adapted him a couple of times for films, and he said, well, I believe in the heart of every work of art, there should be mystery. I said, you're quite right, Bert. But I said, in the case of the play that you asked me to adapt for you, there's a difference between mystery and confusion. Well, I wouldn't put it like that, you know, and we quarreled a bit. But it's a good point, mystery.
Now, you point out that there is no longer such a thing as a famous novelist. I think you're right, and it plunged me into despair, saying that what we have left are writers that we teach in schools, and that is not the same as fame.
I'll say it.
Why has that happened?
Well, the attention of audiences over time shift from one art form to another. There was a time when the Elizabethans, the theater was everything, poetry was everything. The novel really wasn't, prose narratives were not doing terribly well. Chaucer was about the last great figure they had, and then there was a blank until you got to the plague years. And so it was odd, but where the novel had been, it was at its supreme height in the 19th century, and suddenly the best writers in England were Americans, to the horror of the British. But we had Henry James and we had Edith Wharton, and they didn't have anybody quite that good except somebody from Poland who called himself Joseph Conrad, and he's not quite, you know, in the same tradition. So there was a big shift over, and then by the 1920s, all these kids went to Paris after World War I to learn the higher drinking. And Scott Fitzgerald, you know, set it all for all of them. And there was Mr. Hemingway. And they were all sort of imitations. That's what bothered me about them. Because they were the only living models in front of my generation. And yes, I liked much of Fitzgerald. I thought Hemingway did something very few writers know how to do. I don't. Description of action. I mean physical action. I think moral action is more important, but I went in for that. He did not, and he has his virtues, but he was a bad exemplar. Then the universities, most of my generation, when we got out of the army, or there were 13 million of us in World War II, with the GI Bill of Rights, a lot of them ended up in universities and stayed there. So they were poets, they were novelists, they ended up school teachers. And some of the people who most hate literature are now in the English departments of the Republic. Every year, having to get out your notes on Milton, I mean, you know, you know despair when you hear them going on about their sad fate. Then when they decide to write novels, write about what you know. Somebody told them that, and they never look back. So it would always be about an academic trying to get tenure at Ann Arbor. And he's cheating on his wife with an au pair girl from England. And the child was born autistic. Well, I mean, my heart goes out. I'm on the floor. Just it's wonderful, you know. And they're such good people, they describe. I mean, wonderful, wonderful human beings. I prefer wonderful minerals very often to wonderful human beings. So you get these corny domestic novels, and we've had them now for what seems like 1,000 years, but certainly for several generations. And they don't get any better either. They don't get any better. And every now and then, some of the young funny guys try to go the Calvino route. Some even do me the honor of imitating books of mine like Duluth or Myra. But nothing new has appeared on the scene. Every now and then, somebody who has a brother-in-law says, oh, you must read my brother-in-law's novel. I do my best, and my tongue has the habit of lying when I get to that. I have to make him feel better. But so to say that someone is a famous novelist, fame literally means that you are known to the agora, you're known to the people, you're known to the public of your city, or your country, or your culture. What novelist is? Hardly anybody can name one when asked point blank, think of a novel, one that you may have read recently or heard about. They don't. So I said the adjective famous is inappropriate, that awful word they use nowadays, is inappropriate to the noun, which is novelist. You can't be a famous speedboat designer. You can be a successful one. You can't be a famous who knows what, you know. Chair designer, cabinet maker. If you're dead long enough, yes, you can be. But if you're still alive, you're not. So I was talking apropos of that, and I was being interviewed by somebody. It's always somebody with one of those Japanese machines. And I said, they said, oh, you're a famous book. I said, no. I said, I was once famous when people were interested in novels. But they aren't anymore. So I'm on the margins. Don't mind it at all. Haven't lost a moment's sleep. Others are losing sleep, though.
I know everyone will be happy at this question. I was wondering what you made of it when our president and vice president decided to have a reading contest.
Who could throw the book farthest? As you know, that's what they want to do with those things. You know, they're dusty and full of, you know, long words. Well, I was roped in once or twice by the Queen Mother, dear Babs, and at Lincoln Center she got me to get up and read with six or seven other contemporary writers, and I don't like to read. I think it's quite enough to write the books without having to read them to other people. I remind people I belong to SAG, you know, and I expect at least minimum. And I wouldn't say, and she's a nice woman, and I think she, at one level, she probably likes books, you know. Particularly if the color scheme is right, you know. It depends on the room. You just can't chance a book in any room. The White House is, I got all these yellow rooms, green rooms, red rooms, you know. You could probably get a book that fitted into any of the rooms. And I think perhaps in the back of her mind or the president's mind was, wherever it goes, we'll find a place for it, you know. The upstairs study is yellow, so most books look rather nice there. That's how it came about.
Interior decoration.
Yeah. You and I prefer exterior decoration, but that means you must have absorbed the book and it must be coming out of your pores.
It seemed to me strange because suddenly Mrs. Bush had made the announcement that her favorite novel is The Brothers Karamazov, causing Tony Kushner to imagine her reading the Grand Inquisitor chapter to a field full of dead children, the souls of dead children in heaven. Take that, you Grand Inquisitor. And, you know, the kind of nightmare of culture over which they preside is a bookless one or a soulless one.
Well, you can see that that whole group, I mean, I think of them as the Snopeses, you know, they've finally taken over the country as Faulkner always thought they probably would one day, and here the Snopeses are. They don't read. And she made the strangest remark when, I think, forget who it was, a poet refused to go to one of her dues and begged out of it and on political grounds. And she said, and it was so sweet, I didn't know poets were political. Well, there goes Lord Byron, there goes William Shakespeare, there goes Chaucer, there goes just about everybody. If nobody can remember what we all were, my heavens, what are they going to do with us now? Outside of Guantanamo.
Your nonfiction, the political writing in particular recently, do you feel that there are American people who can be sufficiently influenced by an essayist to make a difference in the caliber of political life?
Well, if I were to make a prediction of the sort that one ought not, never to make, but I would say in 100 years, prose will be entirely the department of the essayist. The novel will just be nothing but notes toward a screenplay, or perhaps even a screenplay. The essay is very necessary, and most people find trouble with it because sometimes the language is too difficult, or sometimes the thinking is too difficult for them. They can become addicted, and when they become addicted, they are now plugged into civilization in a way that they never will be by poetry if they don't take to poetry or the novel. And it is amazing. I mean, I read Montaigne all the time just to steady my nerves. And Montaigne...
Which translation do you prefer, by the way?
Screech. Awful name for a translator, I'm sorry. But Professor Screech is the best one. And Montaigne, well, what you get immediately, somebody 500 years dead is whispering in your ear. And as you turn the pages, he's coming back to life. Well, I'd rather hear from him than perhaps Ernest Hemingway in a novel telling me one of the stories about, you know, what kind of Superman he was, you know, Papa this and Papa that. Well, Papa can go boil his head for all I care. But I want to hear what Montaigne has to say about lying, or what he has to say about power. And it's a great long dialogue, and it goes back to the, you pointed out to Cicero, it goes back even a bit earlier, that the best prose was the work of the Romans, pretty much. Greeks were pretty good at it, I mean, certainly. You don't want to think about War and Peace without reading and thinking about Thucydides. I mean, he's got every warning in there for us that could ever come down the pike. And read him. I read him all the time. Particularly the funeral oration that Pericles give over the dead of Athens. We do not have anyone with that eloquence, nor anyone with that imagination, nor anyone with that power. We have hacks who read speeches, ill-written and ill-edited. You know, the only job the founding fathers could think of for the President of the United States, I mean, we think of these, as Mr. Gonzalez says, you know, he has all these inherent powers as Commander-in-Chief. He does not have inherent powers of any kind. He has enumerated powers, and it takes you 2 minutes to read them in the Constitution, that's it. So, the one job, just take a look at the Constitution, the one job that the president is assigned by the framers, the State of the Union. And they would pick somebody they knew could write well. Even George Washington was quite a good writer in the military manner, but he was precise and certainly did not tell lies. Jefferson was a great writer and the only one interested in democracy at all. And most of the early presidents wrote. They wrote their own speeches. The last president to write his own speeches would, God help us, Woodrow Wilson, who put us on the road to empire. Was there anything daffier than wanting to make the world safe for democracy? Who was endangering democracy? Eskimos, maybe, but we didn't get to see them all that often. And from that, it led on to the current nonsense that we hear out of Washington. If you get a president who can't write and can't read, and has done neither in his life, you're not going to have a republic, really. You're going to have office holders giving out jobs, kings of the brownies, I call them. Heck of a job, brownie. That was a great State of the Union. So to write well is to think well. To think well is not always, but perhaps to write well. Or to try to, which is all it's all about. And our presidents have been amazingly good writers, most of them. One of the best being John Quincy Adams. Terrible president. But oh my God, you know, he wrote the Monroe Doctrine. They don't call it the Adams Doctrine because they wanted to call it the Monroe Doctrine. But he was superb, as were the entire Adams family.
You've mentioned that one of the few periods of American history that you haven't written about is the Polk regime and the first attack on Mexico. And I was interested when you said that in the way in which that border incursion was a prelude to our own current obsessions abroad.
Well, it was our first, you know, breaking out of the cage of imperialism into absolute imperialism. And it started off the empire just before 1898, when the Spanish-American War put us into that business. And I guess who really was the most interesting figure was Ulysses S. Grant, who was a second lieutenant just out of West Point. And he was at Veracruz, and he furiously hated the Mexican War. He said, this is the kind of imperial war that Europeans do to their weaker neighbors. This is not us. We could have acquired this land by other means. And then he went on to say, I have always believed that nations, like individuals, must suffer for their misdeeds, and I believe that the Civil War was the judgment of God on the American people for what we did to Mexico. That's from Mr. General Grant.
We've been fairly relieved, to say nothing more, by the most recent election, but what bearing do you suppose it might have on a withdrawal from Iran and Iraq and the rest?
Well, I think they may well be faced with something that we've never really had on a large scale. It would be mutiny of the troops. They don't want to go back. They don't know why they're there. They like to say because they, you know, I was the part of the generation that was drafted, although I enlisted. But they, it's a curious situation that they're told, well, you volunteered, you signed a paper. You know, they act like insurance salesmen. And you're not going to be paid for any damage if we can help it. I don't think they like that. And since there has been no accountability for 4 or 5 years, Congress gave up some time ago. It's not exercised its powers as an equal branch of government. The courts have been pretty useless. So the wars will end fairly soon because we've run out of money. We are having trouble servicing the debt. Even the Wall Street Journal, which is a truthful newspaper, because any newspaper, no matter how bad its political views, if they're dealing with money, they have to be precise. Otherwise, they lose their parishioners. And the Wall Street Journal has not really gone into it yet. But Vietnam did not end until Lyndon Johnson noticed one day that there was a march in New York City. And he was looking at television, and he said, who's that out there marching? And they said, Wall Street is marching against the war. That night he went on and he said, I shall not be a candidate for re-election. So something like that could be very good. Anybody here connected with Wall Street is welcome to march at any time.
You mentioned in point-to-point navigation, which it's time to hold up as if we were on television, and indeed, in part, we are. And to those on the fourth floor, here it is, and it's for sale, signed here. You mention, fascinatingly, that you feel that the Christian right has been making enough agitation in the Cadet Academy to create the possibility of a military coup. I wondered, that's such an interesting and strange prediction. I wondered if you could speak more about it.
Well, I was born at West Point in the Cadet Hospital. My father was the first instructor in aeronautics at the academy. My stepbrother is the first, the head guy at the Air Force Academy. Commandant, the first commandant. He's retired now. But he was an ace in the Second War, Korea. Went back to Vietnam just to have three goes at it. And it was in the air, there was a great religious movement which has never possessed West Point before. They do not seem to be terribly interested in religion or religious movements. I don't know to what extent because I haven't been around there lately. But I would say that it's a curious thing that of all peoples, that having... We were children of the Enlightenment, and out of that came the American Republic. And that was really our basic training. And religion was never very much for us, except pockets of the country at the very beginning. Now, I always find if I'm wandering around, particularly when I'm in Texas, making speeches, I can always get applause on one line when the subject of religion comes up. And somebody will always ask it. I don't bring it up. And somebody always says, well, what shall we do about the religious right? Or what can we do to help the religious right? And I said, the first thing we should do is to get them out of politics. And that can be done by taxing all of them. That was a great accounting error of the IRS, which said... You don't have to pay, tax on the little church at the corner of Elm and Main Street. But the portfolios of the Catholic Church, the Protestants and so on, they should be taxed, and the government should take the revenues to make our people happier. Give them health care, silly things like that. But the people are so grateful.
As I ask for the cards on which your questions are written, I believe that someone is collecting them. I'd like to ask you, at the beginning of the book, you talk about the lessons that you learned from Hollywood movies, especially historical movies, and you point out that a film, even one like The Prince and the Pauper, was full of historical teaching. Now, I was surprised, and suddenly I thought, yeah, well, that's where I learned things, too. But they're deplored most of the time by historians for their inaccuracies.
And they're well known for their inaccuracies, too. I think we learned a lot of, sort of dumb history, but we got the outlines of things. No, I was first really turned on politically by George Arliss in Disraeli. And I've loved Disraeli as a political figure ever since. He's a little conservative for my taste. And Disraeli made a marvelous remark on religion. The bishops, when he became prime minister, came to him and they said, it's very important for us to know what is your religion. You started life as a Jew. You were then received into the Anglican Church, but you've never set foot in a church since then. Could you tell us, Prime Minister, what your religion is? And Disraeli, who was one of the wittiest writers of his time, he said, well, all wise men have the same religion. Oh, and what is that, Prime Minister? Oh, wise men never say. the cards?
Did someone collect the cards? Oh, I see. It's happening. I'll continue. I was surprised in the book. I've been saying recently, in order to account for the disappearance of a kind of book that I can feel thrilled to read, you know, the kind of book that knows more than I do, that wants to show me the writer's diligence, his experience of the field and of tradition and the creation of a work, an individual work of art. I felt that as our publishing companies have been owned by multinational corporations, no longer by individuals committed to losing money or at least willing to, I've felt that without altruism, there is no culture. You say, in the course of the analysis of The Prince and the Pauper, that altruism is a fairy tale of movies, that many movies like to teach a false idea about putting others before oneself, and that this is a kind of Hollywood fakery, but it's a nice fairy tale when you're a child, and that it should be gotten rid of quickly like acne.
Well, I said also that altruism often seizes people in their adolescence, but in due course, only a few are scarred for life.
But do you really feel, because I think of the publishers who've put out books that stay around. I mean, if we have William Carlos Williams, or for that matter, Tennessee Williams, it's the cause of James Lachlan at New Directions, because he was committed to keeping the books in print. He committed to the writers. And you've said about, you know, some of the publication you've been experiencing.
Thank you.
That you have a publisher that no longer knows how to commit itself to the books.
Oh, well, publishers now they're out of it, you know. They're given quotas as though they were, you know, making boxes of Rice Krispies. You know, we went, 10% over the last quarter. And books don't work like that. I think they'll probably figure out it isn't worth doing. And they'll go into Rice Krispie land or something else where they'll be much, much happier. And we writers, we'll find ways of getting through. Don't worry about us. We've got the internet now. That we'll lose it in due course because the government cannot let that stand for very long, because that is a sign of freedom. And this is not what our government wants for us. So they'll take care of that. But we are still there, and we can still say no.
I'm going to read from the questions, but I'm going to contextualize a little bit. Gore Vidal has written, to my mind, thrilling essays on some children's literature. In fact, some of my great admiration and love comes from essays that he's done both on Eden Nesbitt and L. Frank Baum. In that spirit, please comment on the Harry Potter books.
Well, they remind me of how good E. Nesbitt is. I mean, she really was wonderful. And I did my best to get her back into print in the United States. She's gone on in England, but I couldn't get people very interested. Oh, the language is far too difficult for our children today. I said, all language is difficult for them, from what I can tell. Why not at least start them with some very good language that's also very funny? She's a very witty writer. I think I read one Harry Potter, and listen, anybody who wants to buy and read a book and you get the attention of children, I'm 2,000% behind that writer. Just keep on, keep on, keep on, don't stop. Have you ever thought of how much energy you keep up for the literary press, to the extent there is such a thing, book reviewing and so on? The amount of passion, rage, that goes into the New York Times book section on Sunday to keep people from reading a book. They will attack from the left. They will attack from the right, from the top, from the bottom. Under no circumstances must you read this book by Norman Mailer. He's a bad, bad man. And the New York Times stands for good people. That newspaper has done more harm to American arts, all of them, than anything else that has happened to us since the Bush administration. And at least he stayed out of lit. And I remember picking up on an airplane a copy of Newsweek, and Newsweek had given up its book section, which used to be pretty intelligent. And I was looking around through it to see if there's anything to read, and I got toward the end, and there was a big, long thing on the movies, naturally. And then I found a one-paragraph review. That was all the space they had for books. And it was a vicious, all-out attack on an English writer called P.D. James. Somebody who knows, I've never read her, but I'm told she's a first-rate mystery novelist. Why, A, if they're only giving her one paragraph out of the entire magazine, tear her to shreds as much as you can in one paragraph. And I thought, really, this is insane. This is a culture based on the hatred of the good. Because there's no argument about her. She is good at what she does. She has the people who read her, who enjoy her, who might like to know if Newsweek could tell them what the new book was about. That's all you're supposed to do. The first law of book reviewing, which I try to lay down whenever I get a chance, I say, please, don't give us your opinion of the book. Only your mother cares about that. None of us cares about your opinion. We want you to tell us what it was like to read what you read so we'll have an idea of what it is like. That's all you have to do. It's so easy. And you don't even have to think. You just have to be accurate, which may be impossible, but anyway.
I think in addition to the attacking reviews, there's a new kind of review. It's written by young critics who have been taught in universities, and they feel more or less, as embarrassed as I used to be sometimes by what Benjamin DeMott would do. You know, they whenever they had a grand old American writer who they wanted to have a tribute to, they would get a certain kind of critic who could be relied upon to mouth the eternal verities. You know, he would cheer, he would gargle, he would gurgle, but he would write a kind of review that would please the people who already regard this dinosaur as eternal. Most dinosaurs become extinct. But now you have a new kind of critic who's embarrassed to praise. And all praise is modulated. Nothing can stand. No one wants to give a cheer when they discover something new. It's all, oh, well, there is a problem. You know, queer theorists might find the treatment of sexuality modified by a post-colonialist. And before long, you cannot ascertain anymore what the book was meant to be before the critic got his hands on it.
Well, it's a temptation to get your hands on the critic, isn't it? Also, this business of personalizing everything. I mean, it's always the writer's personality. Paul Bowles, I quote somewhere in the book, had a wonderful thing on, he said, this attention to writers, he says, is ridiculous. He said, all that matters is what they write, and what they are spies in a dark terrain, crossing over from life to death to get their messages through. Read the messages. Interpret the messages. Don't worry about why the writer wrote it. It's none of your business. This comes as news to many, many people at the Times.
You quote, in fact, in the book, it's absolutely a devastating quote. I think it's in a letter you quote that he wrote to Leo Herlihy, yes?
Yeah.
He says not only that the writer is a spy, but that what he is spying on is life, and he's bringing his news to death. that death is the place where the writer reports the secrets he discovers among the living, which kind of, you know, amazed me.
Well, it's as deep as you can get into the critical art. Also, he said, he praises James Leo Hurley, who wrote Midnight Cowboy, quite a good writer. And he said, Bowles said, I have never dared write about America because of my hatred of it, which I always found somewhat excessive. We argued about these things. I said, how do you hate a country? Hate some people in it, but why hate it? And I think it was partly the Flaubert snobism, you know, looking down on the ordinary folk from a very high place at the elbow of death. And he was, he took it very well from me. But with Hurley, he was quite interesting. He said, I don't know how you mask. You do it so well, giving a sense of life in the country at the time. This is the time of Midnight Cowboy, which Hurley had written. And I don't know how you mask it, if you're masking anything. Perhaps you are that way, and you feel as you do, and that's it. That's lucky for you. Then Hurley, he writes him back about something, and he said, Paul says, forgive me. I was just going on a bit too long, because I mask everything. And that is how I live. And so you now have a great guy in a mask sending messages from life to death, which is why you should all read Paul Bowles. You could pick up some tips.
Speaking of that masking, you speak in the memoir, on the one hand, of how your life and your sexual life are none of the public's business. And at the same time, you're one of the most interesting writers on the sexuality of those who were your friends in that period. I mean, I have from you, because of you, a real picture of Williams, of Isherwood, of Bowles, of Jane Bowles, and a whole, even when you announced that you were not interested in Capote, that this was a sexuality that was exotic, peculiar, and unreal to you, that you were interested in the lives and sexuality of men, not freaks.
I don't think I ever said anything about Truman along those lines, having no interest at all in him of any kind. No, I couldn't stand him, but because he was a pathological liar. And I've already been on the subject of Montaigne and lying. And Truman was just, you never saw anything like it when he would start. You know, I saw Eleanor Roosevelt, and she was in love with this cab driver. And I said, you know, you can't do that in the car, Mrs. Roosevelt. And he'd just go on and on. He'd make it up as he went along. He never met her. And the press loved him. Because now they got Truman Capote says Eleanor Roosevelt is with a cab driver or something. And aside from occasionally repeating his lies, trying to counteract them, I paid no attention to him. Tennessee was a much more interesting case because much of Tennessee's early life was spent with women. So they thought, he's a fairy. He can't write about women. Well, he knows quite a lot about them. And had some serious bad times in his youth up until he was about 28 or 30. My point is, however, that I try to make, and I've never succeeded in making it, is that there's no such thing as a homosexual person, and there's no such thing as a heterosexual person. Sex is a continuum. It just is. It's just there. And certainly from whatever one does or doesn't do, no identity comes from that. This is all the categorization that would-be dictatorships or totalitarian societies want to impose on everybody so that they have a shorthand way of getting at them. And we are seeing that happen more and more. People saying, it's the gay revolution and so on. I don't see any revolution at all. Things are in many ways much worse than they ever were. Worst of all is the fact that people believe there is such a category. Heterosexual is an adjective describing not a person, an activity. Ditto homosexual. So my lessons to this is, you know, I do not get much applause in the Castro. But I persist in my lack of delight in categorizing people. Once you start to do that, you can never stop. And you'll always find a terrible category for the people you don't like. So be careful.
I think it's time for a last question, which I'll ask from this second card. What was wrong with you guys? Didn't you have questions? I'm sort of surprised. Okay, okay. No cards. Oh, okay. Well, that explains everything. I apologize. In the future, I personally will see to the presence of cards when I start this. I was told that there would be cards. I've been floundering desperately, or not so desperately, but happily. You mentioned some young Italian writers. The question here is, are there any younger novelists today that you enjoy reading?
Well, old folk don't go in for novel reading. I don't know, it's just we've got so much to absorb that we've lived through that we don't really need invented narratives. We have our own. And on the sex lives of friends, which you were adverting to for a minute there, I only go into it when I see comic possibilities. When Tennessee broke up with Frank Merlo, and it was a very messy breakup, ending in a great scene in which Tennessee had come home drunk and late for dinner, and Merlo was a great cook, and he'd done a leg of lamb. And I'm afraid the leg of lamb was hurled at the glorious bird, and thank God did not connect, or we would have not had the last five plays. With that, Tennessee said, "I cannot put up with violence any longer," and went sailing off into the night, and that was the end of that. I like domestic scenes. Maybe I should write something about Ann Arbor and the au pair girl. You know, maybe I have a secret gift for this that I've never explained.
But do you reread what I know you reread Montaigne, but and I know that some of my favorite discoveries have been your rediscoveries, like Don Powell or Frederick Prokosh. Who are you rereading now?
Well, I mean, there's always Calvino, whom I think was the greatest writer of my time, Italian, dead. Wonderful books. I'd recommend Cosmic Comics. It's wildly funny, very inventive. Dawn Powell, I claimed from total oblivion. Put her back into print. She became a bestseller 20 years after she died, having died very poor, and no form of success ever of any kind. I think that's, by the way, the task of criticism, to encourage people to read. Show them things that you like that you think they might like. And then that's throwing dice. You don't know how it's going to turn out. But so I don't think I've ever written a negative review, except one, of any contemporary writer. I may have sort of ignored them, but I've never... The only bad review I wrote... I always had a kind of tacit agreement with John Updike, who really, whose writing is just not for me. But if people like him, I'm not going to object to it. If he can sell books, wonderful. I just want people to read and to think. But he suddenly got above his humble station. And because I had never mentioned him or reviewed him, he suddenly started to take little cracks at me in the New Yorker. And we don't do that idly, do we? So I reviewed a book of his, In the Bosom of the Lilies, which is so silly. And I'm told he was having a nervous breakdown over this. And the guy who was the editor, the guy called McGrath at the New York Times Sunday book section, is his best friend. So, you can see the reviews of me that followed upon that. But I felt that I'd done my duty and straightened a few people out. Couldn't straighten him out, though. But by and large, write to encourage others, to read others. You ask about young writers. If I see where they're coming from, it isn't interesting. And if I don't know where they're coming from, I sometimes don't get them. I don't find them. It's not as though we're sitting there with a number of buses going by and we have to hop on this bus and we have to hop on that bus. It doesn't work like that. My generation was the Second World War generation. We were furious at Edmund Wilson, our greatest living critic. He never reviewed one of us. He ignored all of us except Charles Jackson, who was a friend of his, who wrote The Lost Weekend. Skipped Carson McCullers, skipped some of the best writers, skipped Bowles, which was really crazy because Bowles was just what he would have liked. But he had nobody to tell him what was in the books that kept coming in over the transom. So we lost the great critic of that period, and we haven't had a great period of my period, a great critic of my period. And it's all kind of rushed by very fast.
I hate to be the person that has to draw this to a close. It's the most difficult part of my job. But I must thank you both very much for being here. You were delightful. There will be books sold in the lobby. We thank all of you for being here tonight. Mr. Vidal, Michael Silverblatt, thank you very, very much.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. This program was co-presented by the Council of the Library Foundation and sponsored by City National Bank with additional support from KPMG. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. A loud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.